is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. The Grape Nut, Betsy Nash, continues her conversation with local sommelier Jenna Congdon. They'll talk about food and wine pairing for Thanksgiving.
I'm going to say it. It is impossible to find the wine that's going to pair with every single thing on the table.
Also, Father Ian visits Stepladder Ranch near Cambria.
So easy cheese to make, but not really. It's a very hard cheese to make because the animal raising, the animal husbandry is very, very hard.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 22nd, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. UC Santa Barbara has made national headlines for its proposed megadorm designed and partially financed by billionaire investor Charles Munger. The building, called Munger Hall, would house 4,500 students, potentially doubling the university's student housing stock. KCBX's Benjamin Perper spoke with some local architects and designers to get their perspective on the proposed building.
The design is meant to address UCSB's housing crisis, which has spilled over into neighboring cities. The city of Goleta, for instance, is suing UCSB for failing to provide enough student housing. Navy Banvard is the principal architect behind the project, and he points directly to the lack of affordable housing in the UCSB area as a reason why Munger Hall should be built. Banvard told KCBX News there is, quote, significant research that documents the tie between affordable, stable housing and students' academic success, end quote, and that increasing housing density in one building is the way to achieve that. But Deddy Pikert, a Santa Barbara-based architect with RRM Design Group, disagrees. He says one reason he thinks the design isn't suitable for students is that some of the rooms in Munger Hall won't have windows. Instead, they will have virtual windows and artificial lighting systems.
It just felt entirely inappropriate in our region in particular, and as a solution to housing students. I mean, we wouldn't, and all of our clients that I work with on affordable housing wouldn't considering, you know, housing poor people or even homeless people in a facility of that nature. So why are we housing students like that?
UCSB Director of News and Media Relations Andrea Estrada told KCBX News in an email that the lighting systems, quote, substantially reflect the lighting levels and color temperature of natural daylight. Estrada said all rooms, even those without windows, have a, quote, continuous fresh air supply at approximately twice the rate of building in mechanical code minimums, and that one could argue that this may be an improvement in air quality as it does not require a student to open the window for fresh air, end quote. But Pikert says it's not proven that this kind of building design is healthy for students.
It sounds like a grand, almost social experiment that has no real research or anything behind it to indicate that this is a good idea. I mean, there's a lot of scientific research, on the other hand, that shows that having access to light and to air and to natural surroundings and landscaping has a very powerful positive impact on human health and psychology. But there's no research that I'm aware of that packing people into a facility of this kind is going to be beneficial in any way.
Karen Feeney is the business development manager for a general contractor in Santa Barbara. She also calls herself an advocate for sustainable design.
As architects and builders, we all have to adhere to standards for designing and building a building, whether that's the planning standards, whether that's the environmental standards, the building code, and the Coastal Commission. And unfortunately, it appears that the University of California is trying to circumvent all that, and it's really unfortunate.
Feeney recalls her own experience in student housing and how she feels Munger Hall would be a completely different experience.
I think I just think back to when I was a student and living in a dorm. We had small rooms with a roommate, typically, so you could have a one-on-one interpersonal exchange. And then it was around a cluster of rooms. I think there were six or seven, so that you could have a larger social network, not put in a large space with 4,500 other students. It just seems, to me, structurally, socially not acceptable. So,
Andrea Estrada with UCSB said Charles Munger's design is meant to encourage collaboration and social interaction between students. In order to achieve that goal, Estrada says the bedrooms are made as efficient as possible and shared spaces are enhanced, which, quote, is Mr. Munger's approach to substantively improving the mental and emotional health of the students, end quote. Santa Barbara-based architect Matt Busselet acknowledges the need for student housing amid an affordable housing crisis in the area, but says Munger Hall is not the way to address that.
Housing is important. Student housing is needed. I think everyone realizes that, but it shouldn't be at the expense of student health, student safety. You know, I think the university needs to take a step back and look at what they have on the table and really kind of look at ways of minimizing this big, massive, bulky building that they're proposing. It's just one big, giant block. And I think that's what a lot of people, including a lot of the design professionals in this community, are kind of appalled by.
On the question of student safety and the building's safety features, Navy Benvard says his firm hired an engineering consultant to perform a mass motion modeling study to determine the time necessary to completely evacuate the building in a worst-case scenario. He says the results were, quote, impressive, as the modeling determined that all able-bodied occupants would be able to exit the building in less than 10 minutes, and disabled people, quote, will have access to several safe areas of refuge from which first responders can assist them in evacuating the building. Benvard also pointed out that the building has several dedicated offices for mental health professionals in case anyone needs those services. Vandana Balachandran is a Santa Barbara-based designer. She recommends increasing housing density in the area around UCSB through more conventional means rather than through one building.
I think we could start with changes in policy in terms of increasing density in a responsible way and an integrated master plan, which I think there already exists, but I would say aggressive policy changes to keep up with what's happening in the student community there would be helpful.
But Benvard says Munger Hall would provide an additional 4,500 beds on a site that is approximately 6 acres, and that in order to provide that many beds in a more traditional dormitory approach, it would require more than 30 acres of land. Andrea Estrada with UCSB said the university is, quote, delighted to be moving forward with this project that directly addresses the campus's great needs for more student housing, end quote. However, Estrada acknowledged not everyone may want to live in a building like Munger Hall, and that the university will offer another housing option for students who want to live on campus and prefer private bedrooms attached to community areas. For KCBX News, I'm Benjamin Perper.
Let's join Betsy Nash, the Grape Nut, as she continues to share with us what she is learning about wine.
Hi, welcome back to my conversation with Jenna Congdon, a sommelier who actually specializes in imported wines. And since I was going to have her here with me today and we're going to talk about some Thanksgiving wine pairings, I thought I'd ask her a little bit about the difference between the French and American or domestic version of some of these wines.
I'm looking at two bottles here. We have a Scar of the Sea. That is from Vino de los Ranchos.
Yes.
Is the name of the winery.
That's the name. And then, well, the name of the winery is Scar of the Sea.
Oh, sorry.
But the name of their wine is Vino de los Ranchos. This particular bottling.
Boy, that's the one that's not even in French. You'd think I'd be able to figure that out. Yeah. And then this other one is Marsannay, Cuvée Marie Regano.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and this is from Burgundy, and it's just labeled a red Burgundy wine. But yeah. Does Marsannay tell me what it is?
No. Well, sort of, yes. If you are educated, yes. Ah. And here's the funny thing. This is like one of the biggest visual clues of Burgundy versus California, or, you know, Old World versus New World, which is another way I say this, is in France, the place is so important. And if you look at this label, Marsannay is enormous on the label. This is a village, an appellation in Burgundy.
Okay.
This isn't even the producer. This
that would
is
be
just
like
the location.
Like saying Santa Rita Hills.
Yeah, so that okay. If we looked at a wine in Santa Rita Hills was the biggest part of a label. And then down here in this very small gold font at the bottom of the label, it says Domaine Charles Audouin.
Okay.
So this is the name of the winery.
And the opposite here, we've got Scar of the Sea, and way down at the bottom in tiny font, we have Santa Maria Valley.
Yes. Oh. You'll have to search for it.
Yeah, interesting.
You'll have to search for it. But another difficult thing with France is many times they do not put the grape variety on the label. And you have to know as the consumer, oh, this says Marsannay and it says red wine from Burgundy.
Yeah.
And I know that if it's a red wine from Burgundy and Marsannay, it is going to be Pinot Noir because that's the only red wine grape that you're allowed to put that place name on the label.
Now, what other red wine would you grow in Burgundy?
On the south end of Burgundy, you do have Beaujolais. And Beaujolais is Gamay. So if it has Beaujolais on the label, that is still technically a part of Burgundy, and that will always be Gamay.
Okay.
But otherwise, if it's red and it's Burgundy, it's Pinot Noir.
Gotcha.
Always.
Gotcha.
That Burgundy's easy, right? Because if it's white and it's Burgundy, it's Chardonnay, okay. Unless it says Aligoté on the label. That's a whole nother.
Yeah, it's another show. Early on, when I used to drink a jug of Gallo, not all in one sitting, a jug of Gallo Hardy Burgundy.
Yeah.
I was drinking a Pinot?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Most likely, it could have had some Valdiguet in it and maybe some Zinfandel. At that point in time, what would they have? Like Fumé Blanc.
Yeah, sure. I remember
which
that.
Which was usually Sauvignon Blanc. All kinds of things that they said were Chablis. It wasn't Chablis. Sometimes it was Chardonnay. Sometimes it was mixed with Sauvignon Blanc or whatever white wine grapes they happen to have on hand.
Wow.
That would go in the jug. But most likely you were not drinking Pinot Noir.
When I think back on it, it doesn't remind me of Pinot Noir for sure. We talked about appellations, and is that what they're called in France as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So in France, they have a whole network of laws and regulations. We have some here in California also, but not nearly as strict as what they have set up in France.
Okay.
And so based on what appellation you're in, that will tell you what grape varieties you're allowed to plant and still put that name on it. It'll also give you guidelines on when to harvest, when you can begin harvest. How much fruit you can harvest. They'll limit the yields.
Wow.
Based on the grape variety there to keep the quality level as high as they can for this village. They're trying to promote, as you see, biggest
yeah.
part of the label. So uh-huh. they want everyone to know that this is from Marsanne, which is actually a pretty young appellation in Burgundy. It's established in 1973, and that's young. For example, this winery, Charles Audouin, right now Cyril Audouin is the winemaker and the farmer, and he is fifth generation winemaker owner of this family. Oh, there you go. You're doing the slurping.
I'm doing my slurping because I want to try this. It's had a chance to breathe a little while in my glass, but...
Yeah, so we talk about the five S's. Or we
do?
Yes, when you taste... Now I have to remember the five S's now that I've said that.
Probably sip and swirl. I got two of them.
Sip and swirl, but before you even do that, you have sight. So you look at the wine. If you have something like white in front of you to see the color of the wine, you can also see how like see-through the wine is, how opaque the wine is.
Okay.
People talk about when, and then you, so you see, and then you...
Why do I care about how opaque the wine is?
That can tell you a lot about the alcohol level of the wine, the grape variety. It can tell you about the quality of the wine, not as far as whether it's expensive wine or an inexpensive wine, but more of, has it been aging for a long time? Has it been well aged?
Oh.
Or has it been sitting in your hot car? Or like, did you put it on top of the refrigerator?
Yes.
Over email?
What is that about?
Why do people do that?
Why do people who are design kitchens, why aren't they
bad guys?
Don't do that. It may have been in your class that I took here at the Wine Sneak where you talked about kind of an amber
mm-hmm.
edge.
You can see on here that on our wine that we're looking at now, mm-hmm. you can see sort of a watery edge.
Yes. Yeah.
And actually, if you look at the other, we're so lucky here. We have two glasses of wine in front of us. And one is from California. Yeah. And that's a Pinot Noir thing, really. That kind of like cooler climate Pinot Noir will have this slightly watery edge.
Boy, this one from Santa Maria sure smells bigger. And the fruit is much more pronounced.
Spicier, too.
Well, yeah, you can help me with identifying. I've already admitted to my little grape nuts that I'm not that good at identifying.
Yeah, so...
Mm. Oh, that's good.
The winemaker for Scaravasi, Mikey Juni, young man, really fantastic winemaker. He loves to use whole cluster.
Oh.
So when we talk about whole cluster, it's not that you won't always see on the back label in those beautiful flowery descriptions. but what you might see is that they might talk about like an added spice character, a clove aspect to the wine. That's what I often get when a whole cluster is used.
Huh.
And basically whole cluster is just when you don't take the grapes off the stem.
Yeah.
And so you're fermenting the grapes on the stems. And doing all your punch downs and your pump overs that you do in harvest.
which we talked about last month at Tally. So you already know those.
Oh, good. I don't have to describe that part.
No, we don't.
And so you're doing all of that on the stems.
Okay.
You're not de-stemming the wine first. Whereas the first wine that we smelled and tasted from Burgundy is 100% de-stemmed. So there are no stems in the Audouin.
I think I can really taste that.
Forgot about the five S's.
Okay.
So sight, smell, because you want to smell it first, and then you'll...
The nose. And I'm sticking my nose all the way
in. You gotta stick it all the way in. Like, I see people kind of hold the glass away from it and like, I'm like, what are you doing? Really stick your nose in there, you know?
I remember when we used to smell the cork.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so you can smell the cork to see if it has cork taint, if it has TCA, if the wine is corked. Sometimes if I smell a wine and it's just like a little more muted than I'm used to, which can be an indication of like a very low level of TCA, the chemical component that causes corkiness, corked wine, I'll smell the cork. Mm-hmm. And if it smells musty and cardboardy, then I know it came from the cork, that it has TCA.
And the cork just means air got in, right?
Well, no. Sort of. It's like a whole process with the bleach that they'll sometimes use to clean.
Oh.
Yeah. So it has to do with the production of the corks.
Gotcha.
Yeah. We did sight.
Sight.
Sniff. Swirl. Slurp. No, just kidding.
I did sip.
Sip. And the last one is really only if you're tasting a bunch of wines throughout the day,
which is spit.
Spit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if we wanted to use five S's, you could say swallow.
Oh, good.
Let's just put that in. That starts with an S too.
It is. I love that. All right. So we put some food out in front of us. And these are things that I just grabbed out of my fridge. So I've got Colby Jack. Mm-hmm. And I've got Swiss. Is there any wine that goes with Swiss? Or does this need to be a nice Pilsner, a nice German beer?
There's some great wines that can go with Swiss.
Yeah.
I don't know that we have them necessarily in front of us. Those things with the food pairing is, you know, you want to taste the wine on its own first and then taste the food. Then you can see like what the wine does to the food and then taste the wine again.
Oh, okay.
And see how it changes the wine.
All right. So I'm going to taste the Scar of the Sea. I'm smelling. I've already looked at it. It's swirled. And now I'm going to have a piece of ham.
Oh, I think this is going to work.
Is this going to work?
Uh-huh. This I think the smokiness of the ham with brighter fruit wine shows really well. I think pork and Pinot Noir is almost always a good idea.
All right.
As long as it's not too spicy.
Right. All right, let's talk turkey.
Pinot Noir is great with turkey.
That's what I heard. I recently... in the last 30 years, developed an allergy to several foods, one of which is turkey, which broke my heart.
Mm.
Except that now, in my family, we get to have turkey and prime rib.
Oh, wow.
For Thanksgiving. There's not one wine that's going to work with that.
Yeah, here's the thing about Thanksgiving. Everyone talks about Thanksgiving wines for the table.
Uh-huh.
It is impossible. I'm going to say it. It is impossible to find the wine that's going to pair with every single thing on the table.
Thank you.
I mean, maybe champagne.
Well.
If you just want to drink champagne the whole way through,
not
you could
problem.
Probably do that. Mm-hmm. But there are too many flavor components going on between the cranberry sauce and the stuffing and the sweet potato casserole.
Creamed onions.
What else? The green bean casserole. There's just too much going on. And that's why you just really need to do this fun little gamut. Find your favorite wines that you want to show for Thanksgiving. Pour yourself a third of a glass and taste it with your meal. And then pour yourself a third of a glass of something else and taste it with your meal. So what we try to do when you make those like Thanksgiving best pairing lists that you see everywhere
right now.
Is we find flexible wines that
like
do
what?
Well with food, period. Pinot Noir is one of them. It can go with some of those lighter dishes. It can go with some spicier dishes, something like fuller and richer and fattier. It won't overwhelm anything.
Like a Syrah or a Zin might.
Yeah, and the Syrah, it depends on where it's from. Again, like a warmer, a cool climate Syrah, like from Crozes Hermitage, from France, would be, actually work pretty well at a Thanksgiving table,
I think.
Is that
going to be peppery?
It's going to be a little peppery. The fruit quality is going to be a fresher fruit quality.
Okay.
Not not so like big, jammy, dry that you get in Paso Robles Syrah. The alcohol is lower. The oak isn't as apparent normally. So sometimes alcohol and oak can equal difficult wine pairings with food.
Yeah.
Or more narrow wine pairings with food. You know, that's why they say steak and cab.
My guest today is Jenna Congdon, the sommelier we've been speaking to here at the Wine Sneak about turkey pairings and what to drink with all the side dishes Thanksgiving.
Oh, I forgot to bring butter. When you taste any wine, it's better after butter, isn't it?
Yeah, fat is great with everything.
Ooh. Yeah, thank you. I think so too.
Really, truly.
Are there any whites? So you mentioned Pinot being a versatile wine. What whites are versatile?
Okay, so I'm going to put this out there, and this is like an unpopular opinion amongst the general masses, and it really is something that most of the sommelier community is always kind of flying the flag for, and the rest of the wine drinking community is like, nope. But I'm going to say Riesling.
A dry Riesling?
Even something with just a tiny bit of residual sugar would work. Dry Riesling's great. But when you talk about that dry Riesling, you can still have 7 grams of residual sugar and it could still taste dry to you. It's because of the acidity. We talked about the balance. So the more acidity you have in your Riesling, the more residual sugar you can get away with.
The first white wine I ever drank, I think, was a Riesling. I didn't like the Gewürztraminer because it was way too florally and sweet all at once.
It can be very floral.
But the Riesling I liked, and it was a German. I remember one of the first things I learned was about Ausschluss and Spätlese and the different pickings and how much residual sugar
would be. This is really one
in.
Of the first things you ever learned about wine? Wow, that's impressive.
Well, I don't know much else.
Another one of that food-friendly white, Chenin Blanc. Really fantastic food pairing wine.
And people are making it again.
Oh, yeah.
Or growing it again.
Yeah, make Chenin great again.
I like that. That's a hat I'll wear.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, this has been fabulous.
That's a really fun
about
class.
Aromatic characteristics.
Sensory evaluation.
That's what I said. Sensory evaluation.
So that's it for this month. Thank you again to Jenna Congdon and especially to Ash and Lissa at the Wine Sneak across from the airport in San Luis for providing ambiance for us today. The Grape Nut is part of Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. We'll learn something new next month.
That was KCBX contributor Betsy Nash, The Grape Nut. We're going to take a short break. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's time for us to visit a clock repair shop that's been in business in Cambria's East Village for a long time.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Cambria, California. Come along and join us for a fascinating visit with Susan Foreman, the owner of Once Upon a Time. That's with a T-Y-M-E, but it's a place where time never stands still. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Tom.
You've been in the time clock watch business for 50 years.
I have been, like Mother Time as opposed to Father Time.
Yeah. And you have a retail shop at the north end of Cambria. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I opened this 30 years ago.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting the hang of it.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So you have a little bit of everything here.
Mm-hmm.
You have modern, state-of-the-art watches, and you have ancient, historic mechanical clocks. It's really cool.
Yeah, we actually do. And we repair, of course, all types of watches and clocks. But here at the shop, I have like my old tower clock movements. One of them I found in Lyon, France, and we had that shipped over here. That was in 1970. And I have another tower clock movement that was made by the maker that made the Fresnel lens off of Piedras Blancas.
Wow.
So he made lenses and he made tower clock movements.
And he was in Paris?
And he was in Paris. Yep. So to have two items from, you know, mid-19th century Paris, made by the same maker, and now we're like a couple of blocks apart. So it's quite amazing. People come in here like it's their own little museum. We're in a different century here.
And again, back in time with timekeeping and clocks and watches, we're both just in awe of these people who were master mechanics and could do such fine craftsmanship.
Well, and you think about it, when they were doing this back in the, you know, 16th, 17th century, think of the lighting that they did not have. Think of all the electronics that we have now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everything was done by hand.
Yeah.
And they really have not improved on a mechanical timepiece. What they were doing, I have some clocks here from the 1700s, a couple of the floor clocks here. And virtually the movements are the same as they are today for a mechanical.
Wow.
You know, it's quite remarkable. You know, I've just got back from a seminar back in Philadelphia, and the theme was revolutionary timekeeping. So it was timekeeping during the American Revolution. And it's interesting, even Benjamin Franklin developed a clock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was very interested in time.
Wow.
And he came up with this crazy, it's a three-wheeled clock, which is totally, well, anyway, I don't, but at least it showed he was interested in, you know, in clocks.
Back in the day, in the revolutionary era, weren't there town criers that would walk around announcing the time?
Actually, they had a lot of public clocks.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, so you had the tower clocks and all. But a lot of the clockmakers at that time were really quite revered. Rittenhouse in Philadelphia is like, oh my God, the patron saint of clockmakers in Philadelphia. And so it is interesting to look at how important clocks and watches were to an economy. Yeah, England was, of course, all the rage back in the 18th century.
And then because many people in the neighborhood couldn't see the tower clock, you had the bells.
And did you know that there's different, a church, say, that was going to put in a tower clock could buy bells you could hear in a certain distance.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I learned that when I was back in, actually up in a tower clock in Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
And that particular church bought a bell back in the mid-19th century that could be heard for up to 2 miles.
Wow.
And so it was one of the bigger bells. Whereas if you just wanted it within, you know, the city blocks, mm-hmm. you could get a smaller bell. And I thought, that's what an interesting concept. I did not know.
And so today, there's still that residual announcing of time via church bells and mm-hmm. tower bells today. You alluded to some of the master watchmakers and clockmakers in revolutionary era and post, and a few of those names are still around today, aren't they?
They are. You know, the interesting thing, too, is to show you how important, you know, watches and clocks were. Ford, Henry Ford, was very interested in watches and clocks, and particularly Waltham watches. And he, at the age of 14, took apart a watch, and he wanted to become a watchmaker in essence. And eventually, though, when he started doing with the cars, he based the assembly line on how watches and clocks were being made here in the United States. So the watch and clock industry had quite an impact on other industries. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first to be automated. Got a lot of history to time.
Yeah, and a clock that I know you're enamored with is the railroad watch.
Oh, yeah, I love railroad watches.
Tell us why.
Well, I just think that really of all the watches that have been made, they are the most reliable. They had to meet certain specifications. They had to be 17 jewel. They had to have what they call lever set so the watch would not get accidentally reset in the pocket. And they had to be tested every year to make sure for accuracy. And they're just finely made. They're just so reliable. Mm-hmm. I'm quite proud of the American Railroad watch.
So the traditional wristwatch or the pocket watch is kind of an oddity today, right? It's gone high tech for most people.
Well, thankfully, most of the people that come in here like the old analog still. So.
Okay. So what are they looking for? What are they in pursuit of?
Well, of course, mostly they come in to have some family heirloom repaired, whether it's a railroad watch or an old clock or mm-hmm. what have you, because that is our main thing, is repair.
We're downstairs in your more retail showroom mm-hmm. space where you have old watches, new clocks, old clocks. But upstairs is the laboratory
that
where the mad scientists
are. Love the upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a full-time repair person?
I do, and Philip's been with us for 26 years. My late husband actually apprenticed him. And my husband and I, prior to opening this shop, we had a large repair shop in Los Angeles. And we had 50 employees at that shop.
Wow.
And we were doing around 200, 250 watches a day. And we primarily, at that time, we also did clocks. But we were doing work for all the major watch companies under warranty. We did work for jewelry stores. We did a lot of work for the U.S. Navy and for dive shops, because that was one of our areas of expertise.
Wow. Are you still doing some of that here?
Well, we don't do that. Uh-huh. We do repairs of all those items.
Right. Do you do warranty repair?
We do not do warranty repair. No, we just are a small town mom and pop type shop now.
What's the competition on the Central Coast, say, between Ventura and Monterey? Is there anybody else that does what you do?
No, there's very, very few. Some work out of their houses. You'll find, what I almost call hobbyist in a sense. But as far as having a storefront, that's why we're getting so many people from Bakersfield, Fresno. We have a lot coming up from L.A.
So you're it between L.A. and San Francisco,
right? Well, yeah, there's just not many left, mm-hmm. It's definitely a dying trade.
And that's because the traditional timekeeping is an anachronism to a point,
mm-hmm.
right?
About auto mechanics. There again, that's another area where people are not learning trades. And who's going to take care of, our cars if we still have an old gas-powered car?
Yeah, cool.
So it's kind of the same thing as the trades are not emphasized in college degrees.
So talk to us for a moment about some of the coolest historic pieces that you have. I mean, that one up front with a giant school bell attached to
it. Oh, yeah, that was...
That's incredible.
That is quite a neat piece. That was one that my husband and I found in Lyon, France. At that time, back in the late 60s, 1970, they were removing all the mechanical tower clocks and putting in electric. So this was actually out in a field.
Wow.
And it was rusty.
Did it come out of?
It was actually a bridge that was the entrance to Lyon, France. There was a tower clock in this bridge that, and so anyway, it was out in this field. It was totally rusty. And we decided, hey, it was cheap. It was rusted. We could restore it when we got it home. So we asked a friend of ours from Geneva, who was an artist, to ship it home. And we put it on the slow boat from Switzerland, He sent it air freight.
Oh, wow.
So all of a sudden, even back in 1970, that was quite expensive.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, our bargain-priced clock was escalated.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
But it is a neat piece.
It really is. Uh-huh. Probably wise by the front window.
Exactly. Yeah. I had it running at our shop in L.A. and brought it up here, and it's been running ever since. And we did just finish doing a clock repair for C's Candy. Well, this is belonged to Mary C, and it's her grandson has it now. And he lives in Camarillo, and this clock is from 1792.
Wow.
And it has a wooden movement because the American clocks of that era often used wooden movements. And I had it standing right next to my desk for, you know, about a month or so while we repaired it. But we've been associated with that clock. My late husband repaired it in the 50s.
Wow.
So from all those times, we still have a hand in that clock.
You have no fear if somebody walked in, whatever they bring you, you could probably fix it, right?
Or in a lot of cases, there's going to be a few things that, no.
Some curveballs.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But
an old antique mantle clock you could fix.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you have some new items here too, right?
I do. Favorite are my Citizen watches, the EcoDrive.
Really?
Love them. They're powered by light. They're fabulous. I've been associated with Citizen for nearly 50 years.
Wow. And to what do you attribute?
We were the service center for them, so I knew their service record, and I've been to their factory in Japan. And my husband actually designed a couple of early watches for them. And so he was the advisor to the president in the U.S. here. So I have a real good rapport, but their quality is really exceptional, and their prices are reasonable, and they're just... they're so user-friendly. You don't have to wind them up. You don't have to move like in an automatic watch, say a Rolex or whatever. You just wear it. Mm-hmm. It's just so easy.
But an Apple Watch, that's like a different...
Oh, God, that's another world.
Yeah, that's alien territory.
Oh, yeah. Something else to plug in. If anyone's up here Monday through Friday, 8 to 3:59, as we say, because we close at 4, and our nice pill wears off at 4.
And you're at 555 Main Street.
Right.
Right off of Highway 1.
Right. And we're happy to entertain.
I love it. And then afterwards, you can walk to the beach.
That's exactly why we close at 4 o'clock. And why I'm closed on the weekend.
Susan Foreman, thank you so much. The owner Once Upon a Time in Cambria, California.
Well, thank you, Tom.
That was KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer. And finally, on Playing with Food, Father Ian visits Stepladder Ranch near Cambria and shows you how every aspect of the life of their goat herd is part of making a high-quality cheese.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. A couple of years ago, I did a show on cheeses of the Central Coast. We explored how cheese is made, visited the very few creameries on the Central Coast, and had a fabulous cheese tasting at a local fromagerie. But that show left out the most important element of our enjoyment of cheese, the animals. So that got me thinking, is there more to the animals than just taking their milk? That led to who has milking herds on the Central Coast. The answer to that is, I think, two farmers. Cow Poly's milk cow herd, and someplace a little more unique, a bit more niche. That's Stepladder Creamery in Cambria, and their herd of, not cows, not sheep, but goats. So off I went up into the hills above Cambria, where there is no phone signal, no traffic, and no clean shoes, to meet some goats and find out how they give us such delicious cheese.
My name is Michelle Rudolph. I am the owner of Stepladder Creamery along with my husband Jack Rudolph. We are the managers, well mostly him, of Stepladder Ranch, which is where Stepladder Creamery resides. And Stepladder Ranch is owned by Jack's family. Jack and I run the ranch, and that's Jack right there. And then we own the creamery. Jack, this is my husband, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for letting me come on your farm.
Oh, you're welcome.
Sorry, it took a year.
That's okay. And how long has the creamery been going?
It's going to be about 6 years old next spring. And we're one of the youngest people and youngest farmstead dairies to still be functioning in our county. So there is Cal Poly, and then there is the Longpoke Dairy Prison. We're the only two farmstead where we have raise our animals and make the cheese on the property. So we raise our goats here, and then we buy cow's milk from Cal Poly.
And that used to be different 100 years ago.
Yes. So I don't know the exact logistics, but dairy farming was very large and prominent in the area. This is actually an old dairy barn, and this is where our goats get milked and our creamery where the cheese is made is all tucked inside of this historic barn. Due to drought, similar to what we're facing today, all the dairies in the San Luis Obispo County did close, and they were predominantly cow dairies. We are a goat dairy for many reasons, but we also do have cows grazing the property for beef. So the ranch has been here since the 1800s, but it's been owned by Jack's family. His grandparents bought it in the early 80s. And then sadly, his grandmother died within a few years. And then 15 or 16 years ago, Jack's grandfather did sadly pass away. And he left the ranch to his three daughters. All three daughters, one lives in Templeton and the rest are in the Bay Area. And so they're kind of like, cool, dad, like now we have this ranch, like now what? And they all had really young kids, like 5-year-olds, 1-year-olds. Some had newborns. So it was kind of like, now what? And so the ranch was left to like the ranch manager and it was doing okay, but the ranch was pretty dilapidated and the avocado orchard, we have 40 acres of avocados. They weren't doing that great. So Jack went to school on the East Coast and was at Barry, a tech burnout that moved to his family's farm to kind of figure it out because they were considering maybe closing. Jack came in and started revamping everything. And well, he's not necessarily a farmer. He's a very good fixer. So more of a ranch manager and was able to just like come in and redo a lot of things or implement things to make the avocados grow better and actually make the ranch profitable because it was not profitable and it was just a lot of money wasn't worth it at some point. Him being like a 23-year-old, really interested in food, his friend in the Bay Area had a ranch and he would babysit the dairy goats because you have to milk them twice a day every day. He's a really adventurous cook and he started making cheese at his house. So then when he moved here, he brought some goats with him and was managing the ranch. And then in his off time was making cheese. He like had converted a refrigerator into like an aging room. I met Jack kind of at the inception phase. We're both Bay Area natives. And so we just kind of got along really well. And we both like to work too much. So within 3 weeks of dating him, I started having my own milking shifts because we have to milk at 7 a.m. then at 7 p.m. And we only had about 15 or so goats and sheep. We had sheep back in the day. So I just started milking for him and helping him out because he was just so busy all the time. And we could never like go on a date because he would have to go back and milk the goats. He could never stay really at my place or he'd have to leave at 4 a.m. because he had to go milk goats. So it kind of became this thing where we both just started working together. And then within a year, I knew pretty quickly that I was going to marry him. And I'm pretty sure he did too. It worked out, haha. Within a year, we opened up this business. So we had about 15 dairy goats. We X'd the sheep. Sheep are a little harder to deal with and lactate less. So we decided just to do goats. Since then, we've grown about 50% each year, and we're gonna, I think, kind of cap it. This is kind of our happy medium. We're doing goat's milk in the beginning, just farmstead, and then we realized if we wanted to keep our one employee who still works here, she's on maternity leave, hey, Farah, if we wanted to keep her year-round, we realized that we had to start to make income when the goats weren't lactating because the goats are seasonal milkers. So we started buying cow's milk, and then we're like, well, this is great. It opened us up into doing local farmers markets and then having wholesale accounts and retail accounts. And so it just kind of slowly and naturally expanded with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and persistence.
So can we have a look at your goats?
Of course. Okay. So let's actually start with the babies over here. These girls in particular were born about late February, early March. We officially got all the naming done yesterday. Wow. So do you mind getting jumped on?
No, I'll be okay.
Okay, cool. They're very friendly. You can always just like jump in one of these little pens right here. This is Carolina Reaper.
Hi, goat.
I only just memorized her name, not gonna lie. They're coming.
Hi, whoa, you weren't kidding about that. Yeah. Hi.
If you get overwhelmed, you can just like stand in there. We raise them to be very friendly. They're born and then they're with their moms for a few days, getting all that colostrum and that love. And then afterwards, we do separate them and put them in different pens. Typically, we have indoor pens. And then eventually, once they're old enough, they move to these outdoor pens. Dairy goats, their moms have very large udders. They're not like a natural udder that you would find in nature. Like, they're bred for milk. So they have really large udders. And so they'll get damaged because the babies will have teeth and they'll go a little rough on them. And then they tend to get mastitis and whatnot. It just typically doesn't fare very well. And then also, the moms produce too much milk. So the babies will overdrink. It's unhealthy for them. Another reason is they become super friendly. Like these girls right here. Eventually, these girls are going to be working moms. They're all working animals. So they need to be like in love with people, basically. And we'll definitely go in the mom pen and you'll see how easy they are to handle. When they're young, they're a little jumpy, aren't we?
What happens to the male baby goats?
We basically put them on Craigslist and they go to a good home. And we do raise them ourselves for meat because goat meat is really tasty. Okay, babies, this is enough. Maybe we'll go out.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food on Issues and Ideas. I'm high above the coastal village of Cambria in the middle of a herd of baby goats who will one day soon be the key to beautiful cheese.
Or if we actually jump this fence right here, we can see the moms and they're a little less crazy.
Why don't they have ears?
So these are a La Mancha breed. A lot of people think they're from Spain, but they're actually a breed that originated in Oregon. They're a hybrid dairy and meat breed. They just don't have ears because goats that come from, so they're from the United States, we don't have windstorms. We don't need wind protection. So they have these little docked ears, which are super cute, and they just have a tiny little, like basically like an elf ear. La Manchas are known for their extreme friendliness. Yeah. And then we'll just listen. They're very quiet. So when Jack and I, we live, you know, just arms away from the creamery, when we were like doing this, we had sheep as well, but they were very loud and very needy. And we're like, if we're going to do this forever, let's have at least some quiet animals. Also, these La Manchas are known for their high butter fat and good lactation. So we'll choose what breeding stock we want to have to continuously improve our herd. Right now we're milking 59 and our goal is to always milk 60. So 59 is pretty good. Our goal is to have less animals that milk a higher amount and that are very healthy. We're getting there, but every year we try something new with a different buck, with a different genetic bloodline, or if we like a certain buck to a certain bloodline, then we'll just rebreed the same animal to the same buck. So we play a lot of match.com and all of that out here. Do you want to go see the moms?
Yeah.
Ooh, what time is it? We can maybe go see them getting milked. We're actually on our last group of being milked, so I'll show you that really quickly. So they get milked and then they come and eat their breakfast. And then we'll let them in one of the different pastures, take them on a walk. We clean their pen every day, and you can see it gets pretty dirty pretty quickly. They get milked twice a day every day. We do 7 a.m. and then 4 p.m. And we milk 9.5 months out of the year.
What causes them to not lactate those other 3 months?
You have to have babies in order to lactate. We could give them a hormone or stagger their birthing season so that we have lactation year round, but they just, basically around Thanksgiving, they just have less milk. Their bodies just can't produce it. And there are things that you can do, but we do a natural way of doing it. This is Sophie, our herd manager.
So you can milk 4 at a time?
We milk 6, but right now Isabella all the way on the right, you can see the head gate next to her is empty. She actually doesn't do very good with grain, sugar. So she is on a separate diet, and so we put her a stall away from everybody else so she doesn't steal their grain.
You milk them twice a day. How much milk do they produce?
A really good dairy goat on average is going to milk 1 gallon per day. So in the morning we're going to get more than half a gallon, and then in the evening we're going to get a little less than half a gallon. But in total, about 1 gallon per animal. Gabby milked 17 pounds, which is over 2 gallons last month. But some did not lactate that at all, so the average is about 1 gallon.
And how long does it take to milk all of your goats? You said you have 59.
So we start at 7, and that includes sanitizing all the equipment and getting everything set up. And so from start to finish with cleaning and all that, 7 to about 10:30. But the active milking process is probably only about 2 hours long. And each goat will take 3 to 10 minutes, depending on the animal, to milk out. Some have smaller teat holes with more milk. Some have big teat holes with a little bit of milk. So some are done really quickly and some take a little bit longer. And we also do like a lot of sanitation processing. Like we wipe their udders, we dip them in an iodine teat dip, then we wipe it off and then we strip the milk. We insert the inflation and then we dip the udders. The process takes a long time per animal.
That's them being milked.
Yes.
Where does the milk go now?
See that metal pipe thing above the inflations?
Yeah.
So, and you see all of these metal pipes?
Yeah.
So then everything gets pumped into our milk house right over here. So you can see the metal goes into that tank. And we have a chiller which cools down the milk, so it goes into a refrigerated tank. The colder you get it, the faster, the less bacteria count you have in there. And we have very, very clean milk.
You wipe down their udders and stuff.
And it goes through a filter.
Oh, it goes through a filter.
Yeah, it goes through like this long filter, and we also filter it and we pump it into the creamery. So it goes in there, and then we have the goat tank, which we use the goat milk every 3 days, 72 hours, the time frame which you're supposed to use it in. And then we have our big cow tank that we get from Cal Poly, the milk. And then on the clean side, we're not gonna go in here today, but this is where all the magic happens in terms of cheese making. So all the milk gets pumped over here. And we have our vat pasteurizers. So this is a very sanitary environment. This is Robin, our cheesemaker. So actually we're making a triple cream, ragged point. I can just tell by the way.
Which I have at home.
Nice. We have our vat and our pasteurizers, basically pasteurized to kill any foreign bacteria. And then we add in culture and rennet in order to
acidify the milk, and then the culture allows it to take whatever form it's taking. So if we're making a cheddar cheese, we use a cheddar culture, a ragged point, triple cream, we use a triple cream culture, and so forth and so forth. And then in the back over there is our cleaning machine. So you can see it's kind of like a giant dishwasher. That's our newest addition. Okay. We call him Jeff Goldblum. You can see the sticker based off of Jurassic Park.
Oh, okay. I was thinking the fly, but I'm a bit older.
I don't 100% understand why it's called that, but...
They do end up in a refrigerator in a kitchen because the velociraptors are chasing them. They end up in the kitchen, yeah, and they go into the refrigerator.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, you want a job? You would get along with the creamery guys in there. That does make a lot of sense. So they stick all of the sanitary stuff. There's a lot of cleaning. So like, for instance, milking takes 2 hours and the rest of it is cleaning. There are the cheese molds. And so they probably just took the cheese out this morning that they made yesterday, and they're going to clean all the molds. So those white guys, they look like pretty much large cups or buckets. They have little tiny holes along the outside. So when you scoop the curd in, you stick the curd in, there's like a cheese cloth, but it's actually just like a sheet that goes over it that acts as a cheese cloth. So those two things are separate. We have the cup, we have the cheesecloth, and then we have the press on top. And then there's a holes that allow the whey to weep out, and that's how you press the cheese, the curd, to press it down to make it a hard cheese. So they're cleaning those right now. And then in the front, we will see our packaging room. And then hidden in the back, depending if people are in front or not, there are aging caves. So we have different caves for different humidity type temperatures of cheese. The triple creams require a higher humidity. They also require like a refrigeration before they go into the humidity. So like all sorts of things to make these cheeses presentable to you when you open them up at your door or at your house. Super like nerdy way thing to like know about all the different cheese like temperatures and all that. It's a really fun and interesting thing inside of there. So you can see as we walk down the hall, this is like a really old historic barn. Actually, its 100th year anniversary was when Jack and I opened up the creamery, ironically and cutely enough. And you can see that the different levels of wood. It's rumored that like a Dutch building company came up this road and built a bunch of dairy barns, and everything was built with horse and steam and no nails. Obviously, it's been reinforced since, but you can see the top where everything is kind of connected. It's really beautiful.
It's amazing.
Yeah, which was kind of fun that we were able to stick this creamery and dairy inside like for its original purpose. Jack and I actually built the creamery ourselves. It was a really fun 4 months.
You are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Father Ian at Stepletter Ranch, learning about goats and goat cheese from Michelle Rudolph. I asked how many different cheeses she has. It's a lot. She described many of them and then landed on one of her favorites.
A really favorite is the marinated fromage blanc. So it's a cow's milk cheese marinated in olive oil. And then all the spices, like we put a bay leaf, some fresh cracked black pepper, and a chili. And that cheese in particular is really special to Jack and I. The recipe came from Bev Michaels, who had Alcia Rosea Farms in Templeton. Bev hand milked 16 goats for about 16 years and made cheese. And a lot of our herd comes from her. So we like to call Bev our fairy godmother. So when Jack started milking goats as a young 23-year-old man, he found Bev on Craigslist and they became friends because he bought a lot of her stock. And when she retired, we purchased the remainder of her goats from her. So we have like our core cheeses, but then we rotate depending on the season.
So when people think of goat cheese, people think of Chèvre, right?
Totally, yeah. So Chèvre is the seasonal goat cheese. Because our goats only milk between March and November, it's very seasonal. There's a lot of cheesemakers out there that'll be like, Chèvre is the cheese, it's so easy to make. Okay, yes, it is an easy make, don't get me wrong. But you're just a cheesemaker. Try being a farmer. The reason why our cheese quality is so good is because our animals are treated to princesses. So our cheese is so tasty because our milk quality is so high because our lifestyle of our animals is so good. So easy cheese to make, but not really. It's a very hard cheese to make because the animal raising, the animal husbandry is very, very hard. So our goat cheese is just so creamy. It has so much flavor without being too goaty. Because of their lush lifestyle, they get really high quality grain, really high quality like alfalfa and oat hay,
And they do have forage to like have different pastures they can walk in and like kind of get their brain out of like whatever they're doing that day and go to different locations of the farm. So the Chev, I think, is best in the spring and summer. What's really fun about it is if you're into our Chev and you buy it often, you'll see the flavor profile change. So in the spring, nutty, buttery, like springtime, you can almost taste the terroir of the grass. In the spring when they have their kids, the grass is green and they have the most nutritional milk for their babies to survive. So we always give the milk back to the babies, even if the moms aren't administering it, we give it to them, we don't use formula. And then, you know, as the babies would naturally start to wean off, so does the milk butter fat. So then as the season goes on, the babies would then considerably drink less. The milk then does start to change. In the fall, when they're in heat, so they want to mate, they actually, their butter fat kind of kicks up, which is kind of interesting. And then also like during heavy acorn falls, because they have that natural forage, they eat like a ton of acorns and the butter fat will just go right back up. But it starts to get a little pheromone, is a way of putting it. So a little bit goaty. And so there's that day in the make where we try the cheese and we try the Chev and we're like, all right, this might be the last Chev of the season. Still good, it's just a little bit more goaty. But once again, it is super interesting to follow the flavor profile throughout the year. So the goats will then continue to milk, and so we start making Cabrillo, which I mentioned is that goat-cow blend. And so the cow kind of hides that goatiness, but then the goatiness has this beautiful, like, tangy flavor to it. The funk of the goat is really nice in a hard cheese. So we've just learned to work with our seasons and what we have. But I have a story. I went to Morocco and tried goat cheese there, and I was like, wow, this is so different. What is that taste? And I just like couldn't put it together. And as we're driving back, I'm like, oh, I noticed their terroir. So just like California has a ton of oak trees, Morocco, I was on the coast, very similar to where we are here, like on the coast, they have argan trees. And so they have the argan seeds or berries or whatever they're called, or nuts, whatever. So the goats eat all of those, and that was the flavor. Their terroir really makes a huge difference. There's a lot of animals that don't have a terroir. They just live in a feedlot. And you can taste that too, but ours don't. They just have, I mean, they live a really good life, a really good life. And that's something that we will always, always do and go broke before we let them live a bad life.
When I have to say grace at a public meal, I often give thanks for those who produced and prepared the food that we are about to eat. It never occurred to me until now that these goats are a significant part of those who produce this cheese. Sure, Michelle and Jack choose their feed, their pastures, and even their shelter, and they live a, what did Michelle call it? A princess quality lifestyle. But the goats themselves still have to do their part. Without them, there is no milk and no cheese. So let's give the goats some credit. Let's be glad that Michelle and Jack give them a princess lifestyle and that they know each one by name. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.